to the new Practicing Forward podcast series out of the Stevenson School for Ministry. I am Marcia Roscoe, your host, and today we continue to focus on what it means to practice forward as resilient and adaptable leaders in the church. And in this series, we are honored to once again have Reverend Gina Campbell's wisdom and her leadership. Gina teaches worship and liturgy at Wesley Theological Seminary, and her background in family systems theory and adaptive leadership continue to inspire our students and the greater church at large. So, Gina, I just want to thank you for being with us again today.
I've been having so much fun. Thank you for the invitation.
You bet. So, Gina, we've talked about a variety of topics in prior podcasts, but it's my understanding that today we're going to go in the direction of imagination and play. Is that right?
That's right. Originally, I had called this podcast Imagination Improves Outcome. But as I started thinking about what I thought would be useful to think about together, I want to focus on play as one lens where imagination makes itself known, is critical to the playing. And I think we can learn from play some ways to function in sort of this uncertain and anxious time. So I want to really talk about play. And I wanted to start with some quotations from some of the great players I have had the pleasure to know. One of them is David Elkind, who is an internationally recognized specialist in young children. And he says, play is actually the answer to how anything new comes about.
I like that.
So when we're thinking about being in this moment of practicing change, practicing forward, it's a time to be playful, be creative, be imaginative, and see what new comes. Rabbi Friedman, Ed Friedman, that I studied systems theory with, says, religions have not dealt enough with playfulness. They are always coming on straight. Ed didn't think good Christians or good Jews had very good senses of humor all the time when it came about their congregational life, spiritual development, and he thought that playfulness would add something to our life together. And Jerome Berriman, who many Episcopalians know because of Godly Play, says, in play, there is always another player that we cannot see. So he's pointing to the aspect of that God is in all our creative activity, all our imaginative activity, all our playfulness. So when I'm thinking about play as a resource for practicing forward and capturing change, I'm thinking of something that offers generativity, it offers freedom, and it invites the participation of God.
Nice.
And then there's something also about play that is unique to each individual and calls forth the uniqueness of each individual. One of the persons who has been my very best conversation about a partner about play, who is no longer with us, she died much too young. Her name was Barbara Strom Thompson. And she said, play is the first place we see the spark of the divine in a person. The unique light that is each one is easiest to see in play. So she's talking about an invitation to relationship, real person to real person. And that shows up with astonishing clarity in play. And so when you put those things together, I think you're talking about creating a kind of environment where the spirit of play allows newness to rise up. So I wanted to ask if I could intrude upon you to participate here a little bit. I was wondering if you would be willing to think about for a minute and describe for us for a minute what you remember about your play as a child. Who you played with, where you played, how you played. Can you just offer a few thoughts about that?
Oh, wow. That is like near and dear to my heart. My childhood play was so incredibly powerful. I grew up in like suburbs of a town, and we had like five families just on our street that had lots of kids, and our parents were close. And so we spent days and nights outside. I mean, as a matter of fact, I mean, that was the first time I got disciplined because I could never follow curfew because it just was one of those things. But the connectivity, we played basketball on the street, we played tag football, we rode our bike, that's where I got hurt. But, you know, and even among the female friends, we really did take on make-believe. You know, when you mentioned the word imagination, it kind of took me back to that place of, we took on a different persona, like being outside, and we just felt like we could be somewhere else and not be in the day-to-day school mode. And so it was a wonderful time.
You mentioned so many things there that I think are critical to play. You mentioned nature.
Yes. Yes.
Relationships. There's a lot that has to happen around making a game happen. Freedom. No adults looking over your shoulder with the exception of curfew time.
Right.
There's so much in that that speaks to what I want to talk about in play. And one of the things I have noticed over the years of asking this question to groups of people is there is a deep particularity to the way people remember their childhood play. It's vivid.
Yes.
Your speech often gets more energized. There's something essential, like they learn something about themselves in that time. And the thing I think about it is, that memory is such a resource when we are in situations where we don't know what to do. Mm. You know, nobody told us how to play. We figured it out. And if we could bring that spirit of adventure and think of the life of the church right now, the life of congregations right now, the life of our communities, our families, in a more playful way, we would bring that energized resource, that imaginative capacity, in a way that I think would put us in the moment differently. I remember one time when I asked this question. I have a clergyman who's in one of the groups I run, coaching groups, and he's had a long history, and this is not private. He's had a long history with addiction and work in AA. And he said, if you had asked me about my childhood, I would have told you about all the dysfunction in my family.
Oh, right.
But you asked me about my play, and I had a completely different experience. I find myself writing about freedom and creativity, a sense of being protected and having fun, of being totally absorbed in things I found satisfying. Now, I know enough about his family to know that's not how he felt as a child. But in his play, it gave him a quality to transcend all of that, to find his self and things that satisfied him and to live there. And I thought that was an excellent example of why touching our play as a child offers something. Mm. And one other person, I'll share one more thing. Yet another friend, much beloved, who died too young. But she wrote a poem for me when I asked her to describe her play as a child. And she called it New Mexican Play. As a child, my feet knew four conditions: school shoes, church shoes, play shoes, and bare feet. As much as I loved school and church, my play shoes and calloused feet experienced the most adventures. Building forts in the desert, often close enough for mother's whistle, but 1,000 miles away in play. Multi-age kickball in the middle of the street, Monopoly in a friend's basement, kick the can after dark, holding onto a frayed brown rope tied to a bike's rear, clickety-clack metal skates clamped to my play shoes as I was whipped around corners in exhilaration. Spending much of one summer as witches, sister, friend, and me, all with chosen names, once cooking up a concoction, desert seeds, berries, kerosene, and more, and offering it to the boys who happened by. occasionally and other summers relenting to a sticker fight when the infusion of thrill was needed, walking shoeless on concrete, asphalt, or dirt. In that flat, we can see forever New Mexico County, where the desert and neighborhood were my playground.
Oh, wow.
Just this, see how vivid, how expansive, how detailed, how focused. There's just something that play offers.
Yeah.
And, I think we lose touch with that at our peril. I'm gonna post on the resources that accompany this podcast that initial writing exercise. I would invite other people to actually write about their play. And then, because I also am also a systems thinker, I'm going to invite a way to think about what our family system put into us about play.
Okay.
You know, how did our mothers think about play? How did our fathers think about play? And when we think about being playful, is there a message that we have to either embrace or get past in order to bring that back into our leadership repertoire? So that'll be on your list of resources. There'll be some other entry points, but I think it's really critical in as many ways as possible to get back in touch with that playful spirit, because I think that's the spirit of creation from Genesis. I think that's the breath of God. I think that's enlivening and quickening, and we forget that it's accessible to us.
Right, right. You know, Gina, as I heard Cynthia's poem, and she talks about these different shoes. I mean, what a powerful image. But I'm wondering right now, like, what is the reality that we would feel like putting our play shoes on? I mean, how does play fit into this larger context of the anxiety and the experiences that we are having right now?
That's a good question. The immediate thing I think about is truly playful play raises up joy. And I think I read in the paper today in the Washington Post, the increase in mental health issues and the, and that lack of joy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really critical to find a way to reposition ourselves into those faithful aspects and affects, and play as a way to do that, which is not about denying reality. But it's about holding on to something in the reality that is useful to us. And I also believe, and I learned this partly from Ed, but also I think play is deeper than seriousness.
Mm.
And I think play keeps the future open and seriousness shuts the future down. So in relationship to our early conversations, for those who are listening who were in our gathering when we were actually face-to-face with one another, and we were talking about anxiety, I think our anxiety produces seriousness. And that seriousness, we can get so serious about trying to be deeply concerned that we can't even be deeply concerned anymore. We can just be serious. And seriousness leads to stuckness, and stuckness leads to that chronic anxiety where you can't get movement. And when you can't get movement, you just get willful. And willful is really hard to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And so play, to me, playful play, imaginative play, helps us stay out of that. You know, my husband sees it in me because I'm an oldest child. I'm an only daughter. I'm the oldest grandchild on one side of an oldest grandchild of an only grandchild, and the only girl of an only girl of an only girl on the other side. So when all that seriousness starts, I get these furrows in my brow, and my husband knows I need to laugh because we're not going to get anywhere. Because all the anxiety of all those roles that I have occupied and do occupy just by virtue of birth, and all of a sudden they collapse into a situation and there is nothing funny about it to me.
Right.
And it's not joyful. So there's something about truly playful play that helps us recover joy and helps us recover more ease in relationships. There's this organization called Interplay, which actually runs play groups all over the world. And they say that when we live in a more playful place, we hold others in our own ease. So we are more at home in ourselves, so therefore we can offer others a better place to be at home too. And I think that's just so critical right now. When we're with each other so much, or we're so exhausted from so many Zoom meetings, or the pressures, the walls begin to close in, or if there's some way to get in touch with playful play. And my friend Barb says, playful play is self-paced, self-chosen, and self-directed.
I like that.
So that, for instance, if I'm going to play with my niece, I sit on the floor. She tells me what we're going to play. She paces the play. And if we're having tea parties, she tells me when I may drink my tea, when I may eat my cookie. And she is thrilled at the end of that time.
Yep.
And so often, particularly now when we're dependent on Zoom, we got to get at it. You know, we got to, and there's no way for the other person to show up and play with us in a way that they feel like they have some place in the play.
Mm.
And so when we can think of ways, and I'm just thinking even ways to start Zoom meetings that just invite people to enter a little better. If you think back to when we were together, we played Zip Zack Boing.
Yeah.
And just the different, the way that changes the energy in the room, and the way, I don't know what the version of that is online.
But, yeah, right.
But some way where we're thinking about moving a little slower, moving together, letting people be in it at the pace that they can be in it, and in the way they can be in it. I have another friend who says, I guess what you're telling me is that it's not good that the first Spanish word my child learned was andale, andale, which means
true that, yes.
Hurry. You know, that there's something different about play that is really playful. And another way I think about play that I think is critical as we're trying to think about how we're going to move forward, how we might think about re-engaging, you know, what the stages of re-engagement would be, is that think about, so as you were describing the games you were playing and bike riding, and think of all the things that playful play asks us to negotiate.
Mm.
What game are we going to play? What role am I going to have in the game? What are the rules going to be? And that in that negotiating, so if we're thinking about playful negotiation, roles and different kinds of leadership rise up. So for instance, there, for playful play to be sustained, there have to be boundary players. So this is how big the game is, and you're not in the tag game if you're in the yard we said was out of bounds. You know, they keep the boundaries for us. There are glue players. When the rules start to come apart and the bickering starts, they're the people that know how to get in there and keep the game going. They use humor. These are really sophisticated, if you're watching kids, these are really sophisticated kids who know how to keep everybody, calm everybody down, get everybody laughing, keep everybody, and the game doesn't break down. And the other thing that really playful play does is it creates excited followers. People who don't want to be on the spot to take the lead, people who don't have the skills necessary for glue, but they sure know how to participate. And we don't spend a lot of attention in the church on those good followers. So I'm wondering if the ways we think about reconfiguring ourselves, if we thought about it playfully, if we'd be looking for different kinds of leadership.
Mm.
Now, the kinds of leaders that can lead in a familiar, organized, we know what comes next kind of environment are not necessarily the leaders that can do what we need now. And one way to tease out who those people are is to find playful challenges and see, I think it's a little bit playful to see. There was an article in the paper last week in Washington about how this bride and groom were about to cancel their wedding, and the neighborhood said, "No, we're gonna put it on for you." And somebody provided the music from their upstairs window, and somebody gathered the flowers. It was a very playful, and it took a lot of leadership. And it would have been interesting to study who did what, because that's an example of people who can play really well and make things happen. It's a sign of good play. The other thing I think about is, as we think about playful play, it involves movement and touch. So we ended our webinar with dancing the other day, movement. But it doesn't have to be physical movement, and it doesn't have to be physical touch. It can be in our imagination. But if we can move things in our minds, like it used to be when I wrote sermons, I would write things down and then I would cut and paste it literally by hand and move the pieces of paper till I had it. And Dr. Balea said, you need to learn to do that in your head. So I was having a conversation yesterday with somebody who works for an architects group who are doing webinars with churches about reconfiguring their space for reentry. And he was saying, wait, I need to draw that. And I was like, no, you need to be able to do it in your head, because you're going to have to think it through before you're actually in the space.
Right. Yeah.
So that's an example of playful play. Can I play with my space and move things around and imagine them differently and think about how the affective touch of worship can go out into that space, even though I can't be in it and touch a thing yet? That's play.
Right.
And it's going to be a critical skill. So just things to think about. A corollary to that is David Elkind says that in many engineering schools now, they are having to get students, graduate students, to try to create the things they've drawn on paper with Tinker Toys or Lincoln Logs, because the things they're building won't stand up because they've never touched them. We've never worked with their hands. And he said he learned that because his father was a streetcar repairman, and the people that designed the cars couldn't fix them because they didn't know what a gear actually did.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it's interesting to me that Legos are on the rise again.
Oh, yeah.
There's something about the touching and the moving that I think we're beginning to know we miss. And so I just had this vision of, could you like do something with Legos in a meeting, or just something that's in the vocabulary right now that could be playful, that could help groups think about moving and touching in the spaces they're going to occupy differently. So I want to say that not all play is playful play. I think most of the play that is organized sports, that is organized, dance, organized, those are not, number one, self-chosen all the time, because the adult is telling you what to do, which is also not necessarily self-paced. When it becomes competitive, when it becomes manipulative, when it becomes pressure, you get what, if you remember the book Lord of the Flies,
yeah.
The playful leader gets done in by the willful leader, even though the willful leader was pretending it was a game, it was actually deadly. So not all play is playful. So that you go back to, is there room for everyone to self-pace, self-choose, self-direct in this play? And if there is, I think something deeply sustaining and creative rises up. So just thinking about, and the other thing to remember is how long it takes to organize play. It doesn't happen quickly.
Right, especially as adults.
Well, even as kids, if you watch kids trying to play, there was a Baby Blues cartoon. I don't know if you know that, but it's this family that has three kids. And it's the daughter who's probably like 5 or 6 and the son who's like 4. And there's 12 panels about them fighting over their game. You cheated. No, you cheated. No, that's my piece. No, that's your piece. And then they get to the end of it and she says, you want to play again? And he goes, yes. You know, in all of that, struggling to get it organized to feel like a game, stamina gets built, but also exhilaration. You know, yes, let's go again. It's exuberant. It builds what you need to keep going forward. So if you think you've got something playful going and it seems like it's been taking a while, don't give up. Because if you can find the joy in it, it will sustain. And it will produce new things. So I'm just trying to think a little bit about what I mean when I say play. Mm-hmm. Then hopefully folks listening can figure out how to translate that a little bit.
Right, right. You know, I'm also thinking that our listeners might be wondering perhaps what this actually has to do with church.
Well, I can see that. Again, my friend Barb, her master's thesis at Georgetown was basically based, her theme sentence was, show me a playground and I can tell you the kind of people you're producing, the kind of community you're going to have. And I started thinking, what if you put sanctuary where she uses the word playground? Or what if you put congregation where she uses the word playground? Or what if you put community where, you know, and she has some characteristics that she talks about. Don't worry, if you're listening, I'll make sure you have them on a list on the resources. But I started thinking about how she was inviting us to create playful environments. And about that same time, my husband's a native of San Antonio and I lived there for 15 years. About the same time I was thinking about this idea, it was a time in San Antonio where nobody would go into a city park because they were overrun by gangs. They were dangerous. You might get accosted. You might get hurt. It was just intimidating. And the mayor, the newly elected mayor was Ed Garza. And he had the idea that if he could get the swimming pools reopened in all those parks, they had been closed, that you would see the parks become safer places. And it happened.
Wow.
He cleaned up the trash in the parks and he reopened all the neighborhood swimming pools. And now when Arch and I go to San Antonio, there was a big city park called Woodlawn Lake that was 2 blocks away from the Methodist building when I worked there. And I wouldn't go there by myself or with a friend. Now, Arch and I go there and often walk at 10 o'clock at night. It's full of families. If you go, you know, supper time, there are people out there grilling. There are people with their kids on their bikes. There's all kinds of families with kids in strollers. It is not the same place. And what he did was change the swimming pool. He opened them, painted them, made them attractive, had them available to the community. It said to me, Barb was on to something. Because if you go around DC, what you see is asphalt. The poorest neighborhoods where they have the most struggles, asphalt. And Michelle Rhee, who was not necessarily the most popular superintendent of schools in the District of Columbia, but while she was here, she renovated every playground in every school in the District of Columbia. And now when you go past those playgrounds, instead of all this broken stuff, you see families, you see kids, you see community happening around the schools. And it just says to me, Barb is on to something. And so I've for a long time encouraged churches to look at their play, if they have playgrounds for their play schools, really look at them. If you have outdoor space that could somehow be open, really look at it and communicate something about what you believe about what people need to do. So Barb ticked off some characteristics, and I think while they don't apply literally all of them, they apply metaphorically. So if you can think of this image as metaphor. So she says a good playground has real things, not imitation things. So, you know, there's real wheelbarrows for kids to move around. There's real sand tables for kids to play in. There's real, you know, you have a tire swing instead of a plastic swing. You have instead of some car somebody ordered from a playground company, you have an old bus seat that so that kids can play with real things. And, I think about the argument between plastic flowers and real flowers. My personal pet peeve is I don't want Purell on the communion table. I don't mind using it, but it's not the same thing as the bread in the cup.
Yeah, right.
But also, just think metaphorically, real things and not imitation things. What are the deeply gospel things? What are the deeply gospel images? We don't have to steal from everybody who has what seems like a cool idea. There's enough in our texts, there's enough in our heritage that is not an imitation of the gospel, but is actually the gospel, that creates the kind of place we want. The other thing she says important are changes. So that maybe you have water buckets part of the year on the playground. Other times you have sand tables. Other times you have tricycles. Other times you have scooters. And, you know, if you practice the liturgical year, there's a natural invitation to change your environment.
Right. That makes good sense. Yeah.
And more than color.
Yes. Vestments aren't enough?
There are images. You know, I was always amazed at the cathedral that the woman who did the flowers could get the buds of things, cut them, and by Easter they had bloomed. You would have seen that transformation through Lent. So every week it changed just a little bit, and how you see the movement of faith in that. You see the transformation. The other part of that is, we learn to look for the change. So we're talking about practicing forward, capturing change. We learn to look for what's different.
Yeah.
And that very looking, we're building in anticipation, which is, I think, a faith-based position. So she talks about the connection between indoor lessons and outdoor lessons are important to play. And I think about the movement of the personal inner life and the outer life. I think of the movement between worship and service and how important the flow is. Really good play has flow. So, for instance, she says you sing yourself out onto the playground. You sing yourself back into the classroom. You study the seeds inside and then you plant the seeds outside. There's this thinking about, and I think this is a rich metaphor for how congregations and sanctuaries and church communities could be good playgrounds. Thinking about the flow of things. She also talks about retains the natural features of the landscape. So when I go into a lot of housing developments, what I see is they have flattened everything and you have a perfectly flat playground.
Yep.
And she says that the brain needs the complexity of the environment. So hills to run up and, you know, I used to love to just roll down the hill and get grass all over myself.
Yes, yes.
But if it's flat, you can't do that. I think you can think of a worship services like that. Is everything flat? Or does it have a terrain to it? Does it have a topography to it? Is there water in the topography? Is there green in the topography? Is there an invitation to look up in the topography? Is there an invitation to look down? I think there's a way to think about keeping the landscape. And there's also the landscape of our communities. You know, one way to think about mission is to go in and fix the community. Another way is to think about going in and living with the landscape that's there and figuring out how to tease out the newness. Those are different ways of playing. And so how do we think about that? There's just a couple more. She talks about the importance of private spaces. With all the concern about child abuse, you know, there is no private spaces on a playground anymore.
Right. And
the fact of the business is most child abuse happens in houses. I'm not saying don't be careful, but I am saying, Maria Montessori says, children need the privacy of their own souls, the privacy of their own hearts. If there's no place to go with your secret, then it damages the heart. And there's a woman named Rebecca Nye, who's done a lot of work that says the vulnerable age for a lot of kids with the secrets of how they're experiencing God is 7, 8, and 9. And it's particularly worse for boys. Wow. So how do we create, you know, and I'm thinking about this as something is, are there prayer corners? Are there spaces that are a little bit darker? Are there, one of the best classrooms I ever saw in a preschool, they had a loft and children could go up in the loft and you could still see them from, an adult could still see them, but other children couldn't really see them. So they could go up there and they could draw or they could write or they could do something and have private space. And how critical that is to the development of deep spirituality.
Mm.
So how do we create a space where people can have secrets? And I don't mean by that horrible secrets about themselves.
I hear you, right.
No, I know the first times I began to have what I consider slightly mystical experiences about God, I did not want to say that out loud.
Yes, right. Many of us don't.
Because I was afraid people would think I was crazy. And Amen. So how do we create those holding spaces and yet hold out the expectation? We expect you to have some secrets. We expect you to know some things you're not ready to share. We expect there might be something mysterious between you and God, and everything doesn't have to be about us all sharing everything all together. So, and the last thing she talked about was that playgrounds, good playgrounds, have challenges and risks.
Yeah.
So if you look at playgrounds now, I don't know if you remember those little round things where you used to go round and round and round and jump on and jump off and you'd get so dizzy and, you
yes.
know, every now and then you would throw up. And
we still have one up the street from our house.
Well, they've taken them out of most playgrounds.
Yeah, they're here. Yeah, I can understand.
They've taken diving boards out of pools.
Oh, wow.
They've taken big steep slides out of most playgrounds. You still get little ones, but you don't get those great big steep ones anymore. And how important it is, Elkind says that in the long run, lack of personal experience with risk can be more dangerous than a scratch.
Mm.
And one of the things that children learn when they, you know, finally go down the big slide for the first time. They've done the baby slide, but the big slide, or they've gone off the low dive, the high dive, they learn that the most interesting places involve more risk. And that they ask us to move through fear. And we work out in play that moving through risk and fear.
Hmm. I like that.
So, you know, how is it that we work out in our playing as our worship is play, our mission is play, our thinking about what next is play, and include some of these characteristics as essential to a more imaginative outcome?
Right.
And so I just think that's really an interesting way to think about how we access the imagination in a way that could open us to think about the spaces we have in new and exciting ways, and the spaces we'll have to not be in new and exciting ways, and the ways we do our mission that may have to be reconfigured, or the ways that we bear witness that may have to be reconfigured, gives me some ways to think about it that aren't as serious as some of the things I read in church growth materials sometimes, which just make me feel like all the things I'm not doing right, as opposed to, well, I could use my imagination to maybe come up with something that's unique to me.
Right, right.
So there's a story that might be a good way to sort of end that a woman named Frances Farmer wrote about, and she calls play ecstatic. And it's about a day that a whole bunch of kids were out flying kites. And it was just the perfect kite flying day. And they could run with them, and they would go up high, and they would stay up in the air. And it was just an exciting, long, communal afternoon, enjoying the wind and the outside. And that hours went by. That they were out there for hours, and that parents came and joined them, and they were laughing, and nobody was worried about getting home. And then she says, they had a long-term meaning and value that no one could have predicted. The kite flying took place in the late 1930s, before World War II. One of the boys who flew the kite served in the Army and returned home after spending more than a year in the POW camp. When asked about it, he said that when things got bad, he thought about that day and the kites. It helped him get through the difficult moments. A few years after the war, the same man paid a sympathy call on a recently widowed woman who had also watched the flying kites. And when he was offering his condolence, the woman smiled and said to him, "My husband had that so much fun that day. Do you remember the day we flew the kites?"
Hmm.
Kind of brings us back to the beginning, where that memory, that ecstatic, imaginative, playful, creative memory of early play is such a powerful resource. And we forget to call on it.
Yeah.
So I guess what I was thinking about is, how might we recover that sense in us of what was so much fun and so sustaining and so creative and so to this day vibrant with us, and bring that to the work that lies before us right now.
Mm. I think that is a challenge before us. And Gina, I want to challenge our listeners, our students of the Stevenson School, to really pray into this notion of imaginative play. And if you're willing to share, our audience, not you right now, Gina, the ways that you've been able to embody this, if you have found some ways to truly have playful play in a digital capacity, I invite you to share that with me, Marcia Roscoe at breathinginchrist.com. Or also, as we continue to live into this, share your experiences of, if possible, making our congregations, our churches, our communities a playground that really does evoke hope and imagination, because you've given us so much to think about that I really hope that we can, as a community, maybe process the ways that this has been helpful for us.
I would love for somebody to send me another poem.
Yes. Oh my gosh, that was just so powerful. Right. So, I mean, just opening up that imaginative play, it evoked all of her senses and took her right back there. So yes, absolutely. We invite that from our listeners, and you can send that to us. But Gina, I just want to thank you. You have been such a gift to the Stevenson School. You have just so faithfully walked with us as one of our thought leaders that really challenges us about what it means to be resilient right now. And you've pointed us to some fantastic resources, and I am so thankful that you've been with us.
Thank you so much.
Until next time, keep breathing in Christ.